about that, and he would undermine that. So he went too far in the other direction. But we are great friends, and that part is true, and we won't spend time arguing on the rest. But we will try to launch in a little bit to this topic of the power of speech, which, of course, finds much expression in this issue of Lashon Hara. And Lashon Hara is the kind of topic that we all get and we all don't get at the same time, because we've heard about this from our youngest ages. We know that this is a crucial prohibition, and it seems to make a lot of sense. And yet, at the same time, there are parts of it that we don't necessarily understand. And perhaps some of it is why it occupies such a space in our literature. If we look through the references in Lashon Hara, in Chazal, they're all over the place. And in the Torah, it's the subject of a number of prohibitions and stories and contexts. And we find that Chazal blame Lashon Hara for literally everything that has gone wrong in the history of Klal Yisrael. Certainly our current exile has been associated with Lashon Hara, both from the very beginning point with the Chet HaMeraglim all the way till now, into the continuity of the exile. And the Chet of Adam HaRishon has been associated with Lashon Hara, and just about everything that's ever gone wrong in our history has been connected to that particular Avera. So the weight and the impact and the presence of Lashon Hara in everything that we talk about seems perhaps a little bit much. And what is probably the most difficult detail to work with is the understanding that we have that Lashon Hara includes, maybe even specifically focuses on, that which is true. And were it to be limited to slander, then I think we'd understand it much better. It's not hard to understand what's so problematic about slander. That's an easy one. So if that's all we were talking about, slander legally would mean saying negative, disparaging, false things about people, things that are not true. But in the context of the legal world, slander and its correlated issues, truth is an absolute defense. And yet, when it comes to Lashon Hara, truth doesn't seem to be a defense at all, apparently, and maybe even as part of the definition. We'll talk about that in a moment. So that's one of the details that I think we struggle with the most, because if you tell me I can't make up false things about people, we can handle that. But to say that even that which is true cannot be related is something that really seems difficult. If we're dealing with facts, we're dealing with the truth. So why can't we talk about that? And are we perhaps encouraging dishonesty, especially when we know there are serious issues in the world? And what maybe is even more difficult to understand, and we'll focus on this a little bit, is the fact that there is a correlated prohibition which tells us we're not allowed to be mekabel Lashon Hara. And we'll have to figure out how to define that a little bit. But on the surface, it seems to mean that we're not allowed to believe Lashon Hara. And that becomes a very difficult concept to understand, because if we're talking about that which is true, and we're telling people you're not allowed to believe that which is true, that certainly seems like a difficult concept to wrap our heads around. And are we calling for willful ignorance here, self-denial? What exactly does it mean to be instructed not to believe that which is true? So I'd like to try to spend a few minutes trying to understand, to get a little bit of a picture of the overall impact of this Avera and why it's so central and why it's there at all, and hopefully we'll get a little bit of a picture in the time we have. So first, let's just try to define our terms. So we should note that what we said in the past few minutes about Lashon Hara and truth needs to be spelled out a little bit, where that comes from and if that's agreed upon. The Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, or the Rambam and the Chafetz Chaim, rather, the Rambam and the Chafetz Chaim were the main codifiers of Hilchos Lashon Hara. People think that the Chafetz Chaim invented Hilchos Lashon Hara. It doesn't seem to be true. You can find Hilchos Lashon Hara throughout all of Shas and rooted in the Torah itself. It is true that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't have a section on Hilchos Lashon Hara, which is worthy of its own discussion why that is, and there are a couple of theories we could have. Shulchan Aruch doesn't necessarily cover everything to begin with. There are other areas of halacha that are not found in the Shulchan Aruch. The Magen Avraham and Aruch Chaim and Hilchos Matzah U'Matan brings a lot of the things that are not elsewhere in Shulchan Aruch, and he brings Hilchos Lashon Hara there. But why there isn't a section in Shulchan Aruch for Hilchos Lashon Hara, that's its own question. But to say that the Chafetz Chaim invented the concept as a halachic idea, and that before that it was only a kind of vague Musar concept, it's hard to sustain, because we have many halachic sugyas throughout Shas that are about Lashon Hara. We don't have a Masechta Lashon Hara, but we have a concentration of halachos in the middle of Maseches Erechin and Yerushalmi. It's in the beginning of Maseches Peah. And elsewhere in Shas also, the very significant sugyas in Maseches Shabbos, very significant sugyas in Maseches Nida. And these are halachic sugyas. Agadati you have throughout all of Shas, but just halachic sugyas that are clearly dealing in practical issues, you have in all of those places in Shas, and they are rooted in psukim and chumash, and stories in chumash. So to say there wasn't the Hilchos Lashon Hara before the Chafetz Chaim, it's hard to sustain, but it was codified in most detail by him, and he certainly brought it to the attention of the world as a halachic concept. But before him, the major codifiers of Lashon Hara in a halachic sense, beyond the Rishonim and all of those sugyas that we mentioned, were really the Rambam in Hilchos Deis, in the seventh parak of Hilchos Deis, lays out Hilchos Lashon Hara, and Rabbeinu Yonah in Shari Tshuva, a lot of what he wrote became prominent within the context of Hilchos Lashon Hara. So the idea that there are different categories with different meanings really comes from the Rambam and the Chafetz Chaim. It's not 100% clear if these are rooted in Shas or not. It's not 100% clear the Talmud uses the terminology in the same way. But the categories that we find in the Rambam and a little bit differently in the Chafetz Chaim assume that there's a difference between Lashon Hara and Motzi Shemra, and that Motzi Shemra is slander. And that Lashon Hara is on some level true. We'll try to figure out exactly what that means, but that's the opening premise, that there is a distinction along those lines. Motzi Shemra, we'll assume, is overt slander, that which is completely false, and Lashon Hara, to some degree, is true. The language actually is a maganes, chavero, afilu, bedvarim, shehem emes. So it sounds like that's what they're talking about, a distinction between truth and falsehood. It's not clear at all that the Gemara uses that distinction. There are many sugyas and shas where it sounds like Lashon Hara is an umbrella term, and that it includes all of these things. And certainly there are sugyas and shas which are very hard to translate if we're assuming that Lashon Hara is specifically true. For example, the Gemara has a line that kol lashon hara she'ein bo emes is not going to be miskayin. So the implication is that it's not true and it has a little bit of emes mixed in. Or the Gemara also sounds that, referencing, we mentioned before, chet of Adam HaRishon, the Gemara says that the nachash, that snake, spoke lashon hara about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's very theologically problematic to say that he was saying true negative things about God. So the definition in Shas, it's hard to say that it's following these rules, but this is what it sounds like from the Rambam, this is what it sounds like from the Chafetz Chaim. So you have Lashon Hara and Motzi Shemra. You also have Rechilus. Rechilus in the Gemara also sounds like it's an umbrella term. That's the language based on the Pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, Lo Selech Rachel B'Yamecha, which is the leading candidate for the source for the Yisr of Lashon Hara, but there are a number of other psukim as well. And Rechilus, whether there's a distinction in Shas, also not clear, but the way it sounds like from the Chafetz Chaim, based on the Rambam, but you need the Gnostic Kalim to see this in the Rambam, that Rechilus is basically telling someone what others said about him. So in other words, if I go up to Reuven and I say, Shimon is a jerk, so that would be Lashon Hara. If I go up to Reuven and say, Shimon said, you're a jerk, so then that would be Rechilus. And it sounds like this is coming from a different place, that Lashon Hara is about disparagement, and Rechilus is about starting fights and telling people what's being said about them in an unhelpful way would be categorized as Rechilus according to Chafetz Chaim and maybe according to the Rambam. The Rambam just says that Rechilus is telling people what's being said. In the Kesef Mishnah adds, presumably it's about what's being said about them because that's why it's of interest and that's why it's relevant. And then the Rambam has a fourth category, which he calls a Baal Lashon Hara, or in English would be known as a blogger. And the idea, or maybe not, but the idea of a Baal Lashon Hara is the way he describes it, somebody who sits and makes his occupation speaking Lashon Hara. And that's the phrase also which doesn't come from the Gemara specifically. The way some understand that is that we have kind of a tension here, because on the one hand, like we started off, Lashon Hara is presented as the worst thing possible, and the Gemara has lines like it's keneged the big three Averis, and it's the worst thing you could do, and it's the cause of everything. At the same time, we know that we all speak Lashon Hara, and that's also a Gemara. The Gemara says in Bava Basra, the Kulan Bavak Lashon Hara, that all of the Jews are guilty of some degree of Lashon Hara. So it's a little bit of a tension. How could it be both? How could it be the worst thing in the world and something that we all do? So some suggest that that's where the Rambam is kind of drawing a line and saying there's different levels. So there's a certain basic common Lashon Hara, which is bad, but we're all guilty of it on some level. And then there's a far more egregious, committed, constant Lashon Hara, and that's what makes somebody into a Baal Lashon Hara. And then all of the really severe condemnations that we find are talking about a Baal Lashon Hara. So those are the four categories the Rambam has. And in addition, the concept of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara, which we'll try to talk about as well, which has its own source. We'll try to get to that, the Pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim. We'll talk about where that comes from. And that has a different level of prohibition. So we have those categories to start off with, some controversy and about some of the details. So for example, Motzi Shemra, as we noted, not 100% clear if that's the classic way of using it. Rabbeinu Yonah, for example, understands Motzi Shemra as a qualitative distinction and a quantitative distinction. That when one speaks Lashon Hara to the degree that it has a real impact, that it actually changes someone's reputation. So then that's the literal meaning. Motzi Shemra, you really have done it so much that you've given somebody a different reputation than they had before. So that's how Rabbeinu Yonah understood Motzi Shemra. So there's some history to these phrases, but that's the way they're commonly used today. So far, so good? Everybody with me? Okay, so regarding these categories and regarding the whole umbrella concept, the Gemara has a statement in Maseches Erchin, which the Rishonim talk about how to interpret. We're going to borrow it for our purposes, however it's meant to be understood. But the Gemara says that Lashon Hara was known in Eretz Yisrael as Tlisoi, as the three-part Avera, because it is Horeges Shlosha, because it kills three. And who are the three that it kills? It kills the subject, it kills the speaker, and it kills the listener. So that certainly primes us to see this as a pretty devastating kind of Avera. So how do we understand each of those? Let's try to give that a little bit of attention and see what we can do with that. So, first of all, the easiest to relate to, probably, the easiest to understand, is that he kills the subject. That he's the clearest victim of the Lashon Hara. So to say that he is killed may seem like a strong way to phrase it, but at least we understand why he's in the list. And that itself does deserve a lot more attention. The idea that reputation is considered to be of significant value, and that stripping somebody of their reputation is something of severe consequence. So that's somewhat of a chiddush. There's a whole history of this as far as the way the legal world and the civil world relates to this concept. But the notion of reputation as a commodity and the idea that there is a genuine harm that comes from that, we can certainly understand. And it's a harm that exists on two levels. So one is in and of itself. So taking away someone's reputation, harming someone's reputation, is considered to be a crime, is considered to be a tort, to use the legal language. But we're also significantly concerned about what it will lead to. So if somebody is labeled in a negative way, so all kinds of secondary consequences can come from that. And some understand the prohibition to be in the spirit of what we would call gram nezikin, that you are bringing about indirectly harm to someone else. So in general, when we talk about nezikin, so nezikin comes with liabilities, but when it's indirect, when it's causational, so then we don't have liability. You can't sue somebody in Beis Din for causational, for grama nezikin, but it is prohibited. It's an important detail that sometimes gets forgotten. So you can have injunctive relief. You can go to Beis Din to have somebody stop causing you harm. because there is an isser against causing somebody harm, even indirectly. And that matches well what we find in Lashon Hara. It's prohibited. It's not necessarily, under normal circumstances, something you can go to Beis Din and collect for. We generally don't have reparations for Lashon Hara, except in extreme cases. The Shulchan Aruch says the Beis Din has the right to make whatever policies they feel are necessary. But in basic circumstances, it's not something you can collect for. But it's a prohibition, which could be understood in that sense as a grama b'nezikin. You are causing somebody harm. So there's at least two levels of damage that can happen to the subject. One, that you're taking away his reputation. And two, that whatever comes after that, that if he loses a job, he loses a shidduch, he loses an opportunity of any kind, whether it's future or present, so then that could result from the Lashon Hara, and that's a way of victimizing someone. Of course, we probably won't get to it, but sometimes that's a necessary consequence, sometimes that's an appropriate consequence, and that falls into the category of toeles, and the nature of how toeles works when something is purposeful, and how we assess that, that's a whole other conversation, but it's an important exception to be aware of. So the question of the first victim, the first of the three, that we understand. That's probably the easiest to grapple with, even if there are chidushim there as well. The idea that the victim is the subject, first and foremost, that much we get. So far, so good? Everybody with me? So the second victim is the speaker. So that maybe is harder to understand, but we see that as well, that there is a strong theme here that the speaker is degrading himself by engaging in Lashon Hara. And that is really perhaps what fits most within the theme here, the idea of the power of speech. So the notion that speech is a crucial tool and that speech is a part of what defines us as humans, and that's what the Kuzri had a special category of, the medaber for a human being, and Unkelus in Parshas Bereishis in the creation of man talks about human beings as being a ruach memalula, as a speaking spirit. So the notion that the power of speech is crucial to our identity and the fundamental tool we have to express our thoughts and to identify with the world, and that one who degrades that tool and uses this in an inappropriate negative fashion is demeaning himself and lowering his stature. So that is an element as well. It's interesting to note that there was a pretty unexpected machlokas between the Chafetz Chaim and the Chazon Ish. It's the kind of machlokas that we'd have a hard time relating to nowadays. And it's about a point you wouldn't think would be at all controversial. That the Chafetz Chaim, in the beginning of his Sefer, I've learned through the Sefer Chafetz Chaim, so you see in the beginning, he lists all the averos in the Torah that one violates or potentially could violate by speaking Lashon Hara. So they're a standard number of psukim that are invoked. And then there are some that are very situational, that if you speak Lashon Hara about your parents on Shabbos and the shul, so you violate Kibbut Aveim and Mora Shabbos and Mora Beis HaKnesses. So some are a little bit of an unusual combination of things. And he also includes there a statement which probably wouldn't strike us at all as controversial, but he says it's also Achil Hashem. And the Chazon Ish actually thought that that was a debatable point. And the Chazon Ish said, it's not true, it's not Achil Hashem. So what's the Nekudas and the Chokus here? Why is this something nowadays you hear in Mustar Shmuz, everything's Achil Hashem, right? So why is it hard to believe that the Chafetz Chaim would say that Lashon Hara is Achil Hashem? So it goes to the question of why is he calling it Achil Hashem? So there are a couple of explanations that he has there. Some are in the notes in the bottom, some are in the top. But the Chafetz Chaim explains it a few different ways. So one way he says is that a avera that's serious, that people don't take seriously, that's a Achil Hashem. So that's probably the best description. Lashon Hara is the best candidate for that description. So within that, it would certainly be a Achil Hashem. And the definition that the Chafetz Chaim was asserting, that the Chazon Ish felt was so debatable, was that the Chafetz Chaim wrote that unlike other averas, you steal money, you eat non-kosher food, so it's because there's a desire for the money of the non-kosher food. But Lashon Hara said nobody has any desire for that, it's just done to anger God. So therefore, it's a Achil Hashem. And the Chazon Ish responded to that. He says that if the Chafetz Chaim can think there's no hana in speaking Lashon Hara, That's an indication that the holy author never tasted the taste of Lashon Hara in his life. If he really thinks there's no hana, there's no benefit from it, so he clearly has no idea what Lashon Hara is. So clearly they're coming from different points of perspective here. And presumably the Chafetz Chaim did understand that there is a Yetzer Hara for Lashon Hara, but he either found it a fundamentally different kind of Yetzer Hara than stealing money or eating non-kosher food, or he felt that the Yetzer Hara was so insignificant compared to the harm. But he felt it was different. He wasn't making this up. It's based on a Gemara in Masechus Tainis, which darshens the pasuk "Ma Yisro on the Baal HaLashon," which suggests there is no advantage to the one who engages in negative speech and compares it to the Nachash who eats dirt and doesn't get anything from it. So Chavetz Chaim didn't make this up. However, he understood that Gemara. There's a lot of literature about this point and about this specific detail, but this is the debate, the unexpected debate, that the Chafetz Chaim is saying it's a Chil Hashem because there's no Yetzer Hara. So us mortals, we do understand Yetzer Hara that's connected to Lashon Hara. And probably the most common Yetzer Hara for Lashon Hara comes from another Midah that Chazal were highly, highly critical of, but we are all vulnerable to it, and that is miskabed b'klon chaveir. The idea that we feel we will look better by comparison. So if somebody else is threatening us, so to speak, with competition, if we disparage that person, or best case, at least we're able to bring them down to our level, so then we'll look better. So either they'll look as bad at us or less good than us, and somehow we'll be able to lift ourselves up. That's called miskabed b'klon chaveiro. And I think it's a safe guess that that's probably the most common Yetzer Hara for Lashon Hara. The most common motivation is to look better or at least as bad in comparison. And it's interesting that one of the scarier statements about Lashon Hara doesn't actually come from Chazal. The earliest clear source is the Chovos HaLevavos of Rabbeinu Bachya, but there are various efforts to connect it to statements in Midrashim and Gemaras. But Rabbeinu Bachya in the Chovos HaLevavos describes the following scenario. It says, it's going to come time after 120 years. You're going to go up to Shemayim and you're going to want to collect your reward. So you'll open up your account, you'll put in your PIN number, and you're going to expect to find it filled with all these mitzvahs that you've done, and you're going to reap a tremendous reward. And then you open up your account, and you find that all the mitzvahs you thought you had done, they're not there in your account. And there's a whole list of all these averos that aren't there. So, what's going on? So, says the Chovos HaLevavos, this is the consequence of speaking Lashon Hara. When you speak Lashon Hara about someone, you lose all of your zchuyos, and you get all of their averos. So that's pretty terrifying. That's a pretty extreme consequence. And Rav Dessler in the Michta of Meliyahu, so he discusses why is that in any sense mida keneged mida? Why is that fair? That should be the consequence, that you should lose all of your credits and he should get all of your mitzvos. So he has a few explanations there. One explanation he has is that it's necessary that you should lose your stature, because that's a part of what does damage. That if you're looking to hurt someone, the effect that you can have is proportional to your own reputation. If you're of high stature, so then what you say is going to do a lot of damage. If you're not so impressive, then what you say is not going to be listened to. So therefore, this is a way of neutralizing the effect that someone who engages in trying to hurt others through speech is going to find his own power weakened. But the other explanation that he has there is particularly relevant to what we just said, where he suggests that being that miskaved b'klon chaveiro is usually the goal, that you are looking to knock someone else down so that you look better. So it's mida keneged mida that the opposite happens, that you end up getting knocked down and he ends up looking better. And if you think about it, you don't need to get so mystical in order to come to that conclusion, that very often that's simply the real world effect. Because if you are trying to knock someone else down so that you will look better, very often your audience is smarter than you think, and they're able to tell that that's what you're trying to do, and they'll end up having sympathy for the person you're speaking about, and having less respect for you. So it's actually a real-world result very often that those who engage in Lashon Hara end up hurting themselves more, and having it backfire, perhaps they actually elevate the stature of those who they're talking about, and they end up demeaning themselves in a very real and perceptible way in the eyes of those who hear this. So the idea that it victimizes the speaker ends up hurting himself, so that we can understand also takes a little bit more than understanding how it affects the subject, but that's perhaps a relatable idea as well. And so far, so good. But what about the listener? The idea that the Makabel is also a victim here is a very striking idea. And just to say a word or two about just how striking it is, so there's a lot to try to figure out about the nature of the prohibition of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara. It has its own source. The Gemara in the last parak of Psachim tells us that the Isser of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara comes from the Pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, where the Torah says, Lo Sisa Shema Shav. And that itself is challenging. We'll talk about that in a second. But the fact that it has its own source at all is interesting, because you might say that I understand why it's bad to listen to Lashon Hara, but I don't really need a separate source. You could say that you're simply doing something wrong by providing the audience. If there's no audience, so then there'll be less steam to the speaker. He's not going to keep talking if there's nobody to listen to it. So it's bad to provide the audience for this. You're some type of accessory. So you could understand that. Maybe it's a form of lifnei iver lo sitei michshol. You don't really need a separate source telling us that there is a prohibition there. So that itself is a chiddush, saying that there is its own idea of Kabbalah's Lashon Hara. What's also surprising is there's an opinion in the Gemara that actually the issur of speaking Lashon Hara is derived from that pasuk more indirectly, which would suggest that not only is there an independent avera in listening to Lashon Hara, it's not just you're the accessory to the speaker, but actually maybe it's the other way around, that maybe the real avera, the main avera, is in the Kabbalah, and the speaker is the accessory to the Makabel, that he is the one making it possible for the Makabel to do the real Aveira here. So that's very striking. And just to emphasize how much that might be the case, so the Rambam, when he quotes that Gemara that we started with, the idea of the three victims of the Lashon Hara, so the Rambam has a very significant and baffling expansion of this. The Rambam says, and the Makabel, also one of the victims, the HaMakabel Yoser min ha'omer. Somehow, the recipient is worse than the speaker. Not only is he doing his own avera, not only does he have his own speech, he's doing something worse than the speaker. So that certainly requires some explanation. What's going on here? How does Kabbalah's Lashon Hara exist as an avera, as an independent avera, as the primary avera, as the worst avera than speaking Lashon Hara? What is going on here? And in addition to that, the source is difficult, because translating Lo Sisa Shema Shav is a little bit of a challenge. All of it's a little bit difficult. What does the word mean? Lo Sisa Shema Shav. So Lo Sisa, you shouldn't lift up, bear, support. It's a little bit hard to know exactly what that means. Something like that. Give weight to, lift it up. Lo Sisa Ashema. Ashema is a report. What does Shav mean? Shin Vav Aleph. What does that mean? How do you translate? Sorry? Vain. So normally it's what it means, right? Something in vain. So we say that we shouldn't take Shema Shema Lokecha L'Shav. That means don't take God's name in vain. Say you shouldn't take a Shvuah Shav. That means don't take a worthless, unnecessary Shvuah. However, if you're doing Shnai Mikra in that Parsha, and you read Rashi and Unklus, so both Rashi and Unklus translate Shav in this context as Sheker. You should not accept a false report. So if that's the case, so then that opens up a whole new question here, right? That if we're defining Lashon Hara as true, or at least including that which is true, and here the source for the prohibition of being Makabel Lashon Hara translates as do not accept a false report, so that's something very hard. How exactly does that work? How does that fit? So that's perhaps a little bit of a clue to one of the central issues here, and that is that it may be the case that the speaker of Lashon Hara maybe does believe that what he's saying is true. And maybe that distinction between Motzi Shemra and Lashon Hara, so we'll work with that, that maybe there's some degree of truth here, and the speaker may indeed think that he is speaking the truth. But for whatever reason, even if that's true on any level, what reaches the ear of the listener is false. So even if the spoken Lashon Hara on any level is true, the Isser Kabbalah refers to the fact that what gets to him is not true. And that's something that we have to examine a little bit. So when we say that Lashon Hara is true, what do we mean? Do we really mean that it's actually true in the complete sense? I think that's a pretty significant oversimplification, if not a misunderstanding. And it's a consequential misunderstanding. It has a lot of impact because, like we started, it makes it harder to understand and relate to why there is a prohibition. If we really mean that which is completely true, it certainly makes Kabbalah slash Nahara into a difficult concept. And it has all kinds of unintended consequences. In grade school, you've probably heard this distinction maybe a little bit overemphasized. And so you sometimes hear conversations between children, which are somewhat silly, where you have one kid accusing the other of speaking Lashon Hara, and the other kid responds, "Oh, you just admitted it's true, because if it was fake, you would have called it Motzi Shemra, so haha." So it's based on this assumption that Lashon Hara is literally and completely true, which I don't think is what anybody ever meant. So when we say it's true, if we're maintaining this distinction, so perhaps it is rooted in facts, and we'll say Motzi Shemra is complete fiction and complete fabrication. But to say Lashon Hara really is true isn't actually the case. And we can assume that what the Torah was concerned with, among other things, is that whatever factual basis may be there, still the picture that is painted is not true. And why is that the case? So there are any number of reasons why it's the case. First of all, the speaker could be simply wrong, or he could be, more likely, saying something incomplete. So it's not a full picture. It may be in isolation a true fact, but in terms of the picture that it paints of the subject, it's not going to be true. It may very likely be, and perhaps this is really very much the Ikar Lashon Hara, that it is subjective, that it reflects an opinion of the speaker, but not necessarily anything that is an actual fact. And that might be why it is false. And that's also something where there's significant misunderstanding, because I think because of the way this works, people often feel that, let's say, okay, somebody didn't show up to shiur today. So Shmerel didn't show up to shiur today. So they feel like to say Shmerel didn't come to shiur, that's Lashon Hara. But if you already know that Shmerel didn't come to shiur, and then someone says, yeah, he doesn't really care about Torah, they feel totally entitled to say that. But that's where the Lashon Hara is. The Lashon Hara is in the subjective assessment. And people often take it the opposite way. They think that the factual reporting is where the Lashon Hara is. And if you know the facts already, they feel free to editorialize and to assume whatever interpretation is there. But the truth is most likely the opposite, that the reason we're afraid of the factual reporting is because it also could include or lead to subjective editorializing. And that's where the Isser really lies. So very often we see it the opposite way, but very likely that's a big part of why there is a prohibition in saying even that which is factual to begin with, because it very naturally leads to this editorializing and interpreting someone's behavior, often mind reading, and that is a very serious transgression which isn't fully appreciated as such. So it could be that the speaker is incomplete, it could be that the speaker is subjective, or it could be also that the speaker doesn't remember as well as he thinks. And the fallibility of memory is something that we don't have a full appreciation for. There was a professor in Harvard, Daniel Schachter, who wrote a book called The Seven Sins of Memory, and it's quite fascinating and maybe horrifying, terrifying reading. But he describes there all the many ways in which our memories are vulnerable, and they're not necessarily ones that we necessarily are even aware of. And he has there a number of categories. Some of them are sins of omission, meaning things that we forget. Many of them are sins of commission, meaning that we tend to remember things that didn't happen. We tend to overly interpret things in our minds so that we can sometimes believe that we saw them when we didn't. If you really want to be terrified, then you can read literature, Professor Loftus and others who wrote about the weakness of eyewitness testimony and the things people have sworn up and down they saw that there's documentable proof they didn't see. So the fallibility of memory, which includes, as he discusses there, the misinformation effect, not just the lack of information, but the formation of thoughts that are simply not true, is very, very scary, but a part of why people may believe they're telling the truth, and they often aren't. There was another professor, Ulrich Neisser, who did studies where he documented that even what's called flashbulb memories, when there's some kind of dramatic event, and everyone remembers exactly where they were when they heard X, Y, and Z, when this major cataclysmic event happened, they were able sometimes to check back old records and found that even those memories, everyone's so sure, I'll never forget where I was when such and such happened, I heard about this, often those memories aren't true. So our belief in what we remember, as painful as that can be, is often not as accurate as we might think. And in addition, there is a whole host of cognitive biases that we have that cause us to skew how we process information. And many, many that have been listed over the generations. Perhaps the most prominent documenter of these biases is Professor Daniel Kahneman, the nephew of the Panavisha Rav, which isn't mentioned that often in his biography. He was also a Nobel Prize winner, so focus on whichever detail you want. But he wrote at great length about this, and many others did. But among what he talks about there, some of the more well-known concepts, there is the confirmation bias, which is the tendency to overly weight information that is consistent with whatever you initially thought. And people are inclined to continue believing what they already think and to disregard contradictory information. So that already skews how you process information. There's a negativity bias, which means that there's an overemphasis on negative information that's also been documented at great length. There's something called the fundamental attribution error, which I think is a major part of why we have a prohibition of Lashon Hara. And the way the fundamental attribution error is described, it involves, usually involves somewhat of a double standard, but it doesn't have to. The idea being that when you see somebody act a certain way, so you decide that this is their character, this tells me what I need to know about who they are. And when you do the exact same thing, it's circumstantial. So if you see somebody push in front of a line, he's a jerk. When you pushed in front of a line, you were having a bad day, you were in a big rush, and you understand it was circumstances. So when you do the same thing, it's interpreted as not definitive of your character, it's just what was going on at the time. And when someone else does that, so then it's seen as reflective of their entire character. So I believe that's a big part of why we have a prohibition of speaking Lashon Hara, because there is a basic human tendency to overinterpret the impact of any one episode and to think that whatever you're seeing right now is indeed reflective of someone's character. And that human tendency is very hard to fight off, and we do have that inclination to overinterpret things, and it's important fact to be aware of before you start dating, and to know that we form these rules. We say, okay, you know, if he was really a nice guy, he'd do this. If she really loved me, she'd do that. Maybe, maybe not. And the assumption that there's a complete linkage between whatever action and the midah and the character of the person is often a very dangerous assumption, l'kula and l'chumra, and has caused a lot of fighting and a lot of major tensions between people. And that's not necessarily fair at all. So this bias to assume that you can look at what somebody's doing and you think you understand everything about them, or at least in this area, you understand the nice guy is not a nice guy because he does or doesn't do this. Parenthetically, I think that's why Chazal criticized Eliezer for his test that was otherwise very successful, and we should be very grateful to Eliezer for finding a perfect shidduch for our great-great-great-great-grandparents, and that the test of showing that Rivka was a balas chesed seemed to be very successful, but Chazal are critical of it anyway, and I think it might be because of that, because absolutely relying on any one action and saying, this shows me what I need to know about the midah, is generally dangerous. And Chazal link Eliezer's behavior with superstition. And it's hard to understand because it seems rational. think there's some degree of irrationality in assuming that one action can tell me what I need to know about a person's midah. It's a good first step. It's a good first clue, and then you investigate further, but to assume as a one-to-one correlation is very often dangerous. So I think that's also a part of it. And there are a number of other biases. They talk about the halo effect and the devil effect, that once you've already decided somebody's good, so everything is seen in that framework. It's the halo effect. The devil effect is the opposite. There's what's known as the availability bias, which is the assumption that we have that whatever information we have access to is necessarily the best source of information, may not be relevant at all, just happens to be the information that is in front of you. It doesn't necessarily tell us what you need to know. There are all kinds of biases that skew the way we process information, and we think that we're saying something which is true, and it may be very, very far from the truth. It may be something which may start with a shred of fact and end up being completely different. And you might think, okay, but if I know about these things and if I read about these things, so then I'll correct for them, and then I can go ahead and say whatever I want. So sometimes there's a place for that, but very often we're not even able to be aware of these biases, and this is its own bias, which is sometimes known as the bias, or you could call it the bias sheni. And the idea being that we're not even aware of how this impacts on our thinking. And even when we know about it, we think that, okay, we have accounted for it, and that's much harder to do than it sounds. It may be that sometimes it's necessary. So again, we're not really going into this topic, but the crucial issue of toela, sometimes it's purposeful and necessary to say something, and can't ignore that as much as we're not getting into the topic tonight. It's crucial to be aware of. There was one of the Dayanim in Vilna wrote a sefer, Pischei Tshuva and Aruch Chaim, and he wrote, the whole world gets all worked up about what they're not supposed to say. They have to get equally worked up about what they have to say and they don't say. So he wrote this in the late 1800s. I was never able to find whether this was said before or after the Chafetz Chaim published the sefer. When he says, the whole world gets worked up about Lashon Hara, I don't know if he wrote that before or after the sefer Chafetz Chaim came out. But we should certainly acknowledge that that whole area of Toelis cannot be ignored. It's just not our subject for tonight. But when that comes up, so then yes, a person will have to do whatever he can in order to try to account for whatever biases and try to be as factual as possible. But the inherent difficulty in that is overwhelming. And I think perhaps that would be why the Torah prohibited Lashon Hara, because since we can never be sure what we're saying is really accurate, if it's negative, then the harm that can come with the inaccuracy is tremendous. If there's a need to protect yourself or others or to accomplish some social good, so then it may be necessary, and then we'll have to go back to trying to focus on truth as the defense and the justification, but we'll have to work hard to make sure that it is as true as possible. So if we consider all these elements, so then we can maybe understand why Kabbalah's Lashon Hara is given such extreme presentation in the Rambam, and why he would even say Yoser min ha'omro. Because to whatever extent we've established that what we think is true may not be true, this is much more so the case when it comes to the recipient. And there's been a documented effect called the teller-listener extremity effect, if I remember correctly. And the idea being that as much as a speaker may not be fully aware of the accuracy of his statements, what reaches the ears of the listener is far less accurate. And there are tendencies the listener has. Some of it's called sharpening or leveling. Sharpening means giving greater attention to certain details as if they're sharper than they actually are. Leveling is kind of the opposite, trying to smooth out all the nuances and all the differences. And I think we can all relate to this. Somebody's telling you a story, and you don't have patience for all the details. You're not listening 100%, and he's going on and on telling the story. Like, okay, I get it. He's bad, that guy, whatever it is. So we have a tendency not to even listen to what the speaker is actually saying. So if the speaker's not getting it right, the listener's getting even less. And Rabbeinu Yona understood Lo Sisa Shema Shav. You have to add an extra word there. Lo Sisa Shema Sofik Shav. You should not accept as true that which may not be true. It's understandable, because if you knew it wasn't true, so why would you accept something as true that you know is not true? But the problem is, when something may or may not be true, it takes a lot of intellectual energy to actively disbelieve something. In fact, they've proven in studies the way it works. When you hear something, the first step is that you believe it, and then the next step is you think about whether it's true or not to actively disbelieve it. It's what we call a default to truth. So there's an initial tendency to believe whatever anybody says, and then to disbelieve it takes more effort. So most of us aren't going to expend that effort unless we're really sensitive to what's involved. So the notion that there's a greater avera, perhaps, in the Kabbalah's Lashon Hara, so that perhaps we can understand. And if we look back in the language of the Rambam, it's noteworthy. He doesn't actually say it's a bigger avera to be the makabel. He says this has a negative effect. Lashon hara kills these three people. The hamakabel yosim and omra. Makabel is in worse shape than the speaker or the listener, speaker or the subject. Essentially, perhaps his connection to the truth is the lowest. And if we recognize that, despite our belief that we're honest people, and we are honest people, hopefully, but still, even honest people tend to make a lot of mistakes, and which is why I think, if you look in the Chafetz Chaim, some of the standards that we have for Eidus, where we credit people as being honest, he writes, shouldn't apply to Lashon Hara. I believe that's what's behind it also, because the assumption, you sometimes say, well, why did he lie? He's an honest guy, this must be true. The assumption that everything an honest person says is factual and true is a bad assumption. A lot of false things unintentionally come from honest people who don't realize how much the picture is incomplete. So it's important for us to appreciate all the different ways in which this comes together to give us a little bit of substance to Lashon Hara, which makes the point to us that there are many ways, many of them unanticipated, which we can cause harm by speech. And another very significant way we could do that is if we keep on talking when it's time for Maariv. So I believe my time is up. So I apologize for not leaving much time for questions, less than 10 seconds apparently. But I hope it's more or less clear. And hopefully Pesach is supposed to be a time when we are redeemed also from the Golus of Dibur, as the Sfarim talk about. Moshe said they deserve to be in Golus because they speak Lashon Hara. When Dustin Avirim said, you're going to kill us like you killed the Mitzri. So a part of our Golus was tied to that, was tied like everything else. And the more we're able to address this and be sensitive to the effect that it has on us, the further we are on the path to redemption. So I thank you all very much. I wish you a Chag Kasher v'Sameach.